This hour's top stories: Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, the first such attack since the end of the 11-day Israeli onslaught on the enclave last month. More than 30 Palestinians are injured by Israeli forces during a protest against a settlers' march in occupied Jerusalem on Quds. Also ahead, international rights groups blast Saudi Arabia for executing a Shia man on charges related to an anti-government protest when he was a minor. Welcome to World News. Our top story: Israeli drones and fighter jets have attacked the Palestinian training camp in the south of the Gaza Strip, as well as areas in Khan Yunis. A radio station belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas reported the attack. Explosions were also heard in Gaza City. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem says the bombing is a failed attempt to damage the solidarity between the resistance movements and Jerusalem on Quds. Latest aggression is the first Israeli strike on the enclave since a ceasefire ended 11 days of conflict last month. Israeli forces have not yet commented on the attack. Earlier, we were joined by Ashraf Shannon, our man in Gaza, who gave us an update on the latest round of Israeli aggression against the enclave.
Israeli drones initially attacked two security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, used in Qassam Brigades, one in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, and another one in the south of Gaza City. Minutes later, they used Israeli F-16 fighter jets to bomb those training centers that belong to Hamas's military wing. The Israeli military did issue a statement minutes ago saying that the attacks were in retaliation for incendiary balloons that were flown from the Gaza Strip earlier. Although Hamas is not responsible for the incendiary balloons, they were flown by Palestinian youth as a form of protest against the march by extremist Jewish settlers in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Hamas movement spokesperson Hazem Qasem said that the Israeli airstrikes were just another example of Israel's violation of Palestinian rights. And he also said that the Palestinian resistance factions will defend Jerusalem Quds no matter what happens.
Israeli forces attack Palestinians protesting against the march by Israeli settlers in occupied East Jerusalem Quds. Palestinian Red Crescent said 33 people were injured during the clashes. Regime forces also arrested several Palestinians who were demonstrating against the so-called March of the Flags. Moreover, Israeli forces blocked Palestinians' access to the Damascus Gate, leading to Old City, and pushed them away from the area. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements in the Gaza Strip have warned they would respond firmly to any provocative acts by the settlers. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh sounded the alarm about the dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event. Palestinians in Gaza have held similar demonstrations to slam the settlers' parade.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up Al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem Al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Palestinian human rights lawyer Jonathan Kotop said the settlers' parade is so provocative that some Israelis advised against holding it this year.
Well, this is actually a recurring event that occurs several times, usually once a year. It celebrates the conquest of Jerusalem. And it's a very right-wing, racist celebration, insisting that Jerusalem is just for Jews. And it's usually done in a very provocative way, going through the old city, through the Muslim quarters, through the areas where Palestinians usually live, basically to tell them, we won, we are the masters of this place, and you are worth nothing. In fact, it is so provocative that the Israeli police recommended that it be canceled this year or that it take place in a different location and not in the Arab sectors and the Muslim sectors of the city. But unfortunately, they decided to do it there anyway.
Saudi Arabia comes under fire by international rights groups for executing a man for crimes he allegedly committed when he was a minor. Amnesty International said Mustafa Hashem Darwish was a victim of Riyadh's, quote, deeply flawed justice system. Anti-death penalty group Reprieve branded the Saudi act as a human rights crisis and said Mustafa's family was not notified prior to his killing. Both groups, as well as Mustafa himself, said the confession used for his sentencing was obtained under duress. The man was arrested in 2015. He was charged with protest-related crimes that he allegedly committed when he was 17. His execution was carried out despite a pledge by Saudi authorities last year to end capital punishment based on childhood offenses. The U.S. Agency for International Development says the Yemeni province of Ma'arib needs more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address its growing crisis. Yemenis believe the agency is using humanitarian assistance as a cover-up for its military activities. such as providing weapons for terrorist groups, in Ma'ariv. Our correspondent in Sana'a reports.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Ma'arib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Ma'arib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Ma'arib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Ma'arib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is a proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al Bayda and Ma'arib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al Qaeda. Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
Peace negotiations between the Taliban militants and the Afghan government have resumed in Qatar for the first time since talks stalled in April. Kabul said a meeting was held between the contact groups of the two negotiating teams, and a comprehensive discussion was held on the organization and arrangement of the talks. Taliban spokesman also tweeted a similar statement. Peace talks between the government and the Taliban hit an impasse when the group refused to participate in a summit in Turkey on Afghanistan's future. The resumption now comes as the U.S. is pulling out the last of its troops from Afghanistan by September. An Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats are in Islamabad under what's known as a track to diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any sign of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group. Javed Rana reports.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held a meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government, while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital Kabul if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s. And There is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital, Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital Kabul after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The U.S. and the European Union have agreed to a long-term truce in their dispute over subsidies to respective plane makers, Airbus and Boeing. The truce was formalized during the first summit between U.S. President Biden and European leaders Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen in Brussels. Von der Leyen hailed the meeting as a breakthrough in the long-running feud. It will see the removal of tariffs on over $11 billion of goods. The tariffs were imposed on a tit-for-tat basis over state subsidies for Boeing and Airbus. However, earlier this year, Biden and von der Leyen suspended the retaliatory levies. Both sides have said they are trying to clear the state of trade disputes to consolidate a more friendly face and jointly tackle other issues, including China and Russia. The Canadian province of Ontario launches a search for unmarked graves of Indigenous residential school students. Officials announced an $8 million fund to look for such sites. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said the funding, spread over 3 years, will be used to identify, investigate, and to protect residential school burial sites and cemeteries. Search operations have also turned up more unmarked student grave sites in Manitoba and Saskatchewan provinces. And that's it with international news.
Diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The 13th presidential election. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on June 18th. Presidential election in Iran is very important in Iran. Iran is a stable, powerful, and determining country in the region and the world. That's why the result of Iran's presidential election is of paramount importance for the media across the world. The Iranian nation has been engaged in a full-scale propaganda battle, especially after the spread of social media. The hostile social media have spared no effort to put psychological and political pressure on Iran in order to undermine Iran's elements of power and make people disappointed on participation. In view of this, the Western media and news networks have been distorting political climates and tarnishing the campaign process. These media always pursue the vested interests of their paymaster in Washington, London, and Tel Aviv. They portray a very black and desperate image of the conditions in the country and try to engineer people's minds in a bid to make them distrust the process of election. Satellite networks in the West have always tried to say that election in Iran is manipulated in order to suggest that the whole election is ceremonial and the result of voting is known beforehand. The propaganda bombardment of the Western media is so intensive that at times the atmosphere becomes really obfuscated and recognition of right from wrong is very hard. Sometimes the Western media focus on the debates of candidates in a very selective way. In other words, they choose parts of the debates and try to create negative mentality for the audience. These media try to bold some of the concepts and direct the minds of the listeners or viewers towards certain issues with specific codes. These media, in fact, reverse the realities in a bid to pursue their own interests. The Farsi networks like the VOA, BBC, France 24, Iran International, Manitou, and so on are in the forefront of the media maximum pressure against the Iranian nation. In an organized battle, they try round the clock to advance their nefarious goals. These media horns try to make people disappointed about the result of election in a bid to minimize the people's turnout. They also try to make the society bipolar through forging fake polls and non-existent demands. These mercenary media incessantly try to cause civil discontent among masses, especially the youth. The media such as BBC and Iran International, which are directly funded by the British royal family and Saudi monarchic regime, respectively, seriously concentrated on this devilish agenda. Every time that there is an election in Iran, the Western and Hebrew media start their propaganda war in order to affect the minds of people and fish in the troubled water. They exert their utmost to create an ambiguous atmosphere in the country in a bid to cause people to lose their motive for voting in the first place. Then, they make every effort to push people's minds towards a certain candidate who is more compromising and less revolutionary. Political analyst Qumars Yazdanpanah says, insinuation of people's mistrust in officials and focusing on the access such as uselessness of their votes in the result of elections and depiction of the climate of suppression and suffocation are among the access that these hired media have always sought. They try to damage people's trust in legal and constitutional organizations to say that elections in Iran are ceremonial and pre-planned. The Western and Hebrew media always focus on various factions and fan the flames of people's dissatisfaction with economic condition to generalize their protest to the entire Islamic system. These media also pay considerable attention to the process of qualification of the nominees by vetting bodies such as the Guardian Council. For the past three decades, these media have unanimously questioned the qualification of nominees, especially during the presidential election season. This is why, in every country and ruling system, there are vetting institutions which are responsible for seeing if the nominees are qualified or not. During the elections in Iran, these hostile media shed crocodile tears for what they call breach of rights of citizenship. This way, they pursue the satanic goal of instigating civil rebellion. But they and their paymasters should know the fact that Iran enjoys one of the most, if not the most, democratic system of government in the world. This has been verified by different candidates who gain people's votes for presidency and parliament, while some of them have no belief in the Islamic Republic and Imam Khomeini's path, and have even taken anti-revolution measures. An evident example in this regard was Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, who was a puppet of the West and tried to put into effect his anti-Islamic and anti-revolution since day one that he was elected as president in early 1980. Yet, Imam Khomeini didn't dismiss him, although the Imam was religiously and constitutionally entitled to do the job. This shows the highest level of democracy and respect for people's votes in Iran.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and here's some food for thought for you today from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, the eighth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The best earner of livelihood among people is that who improves others' livelihoods out of his livelihood.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: قليل تدوم عليه أرجى من كثير مملول منه.
Imam Ali said, "A small action which is continued with regularity is more beneficial than a long one performed with disgust." Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, dear listeners, which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept of performing prostration when we want to thank Allah for His blessings. Of course, one of the things which we can do in order to thank Allah for His blessings is to verbally thank Him, and in our hearts we can also thank Him. But there's an interesting report by Khawarizmi where he says that addressing Imam Ali on the day of the conquest of Khaybar, the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, said, "Truth which is not perishable is in your tongue, O Ali, in your heart and your face. Faith is placed in the depth of your blood, O Ali, and in the depth of your flesh, just as it exists in me. Verily, Allah Almighty has ordered me to give you the glad tidings that on the Day of Judgment, you and your family will enjoy all the blessings of Paradise, whereas the enemies of you and your family will be punished in the fires of hell. Your unhappy enemies are not seen on that day at the pond of Kothar, whereas a single friend of yours will not be absent from there. We find, interestingly, that after all of these beautiful blessings and all of these beautiful descriptions given to Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, by the Messenger of Allah, what does Imam Ali do at this time? Imam Ali says, to thank all these blessings of Almighty Allah, whom has bestowed them upon me, I perform a prostration, a sujood, and I praise him. A very beautiful lesson for all of us, dear friends. When we have blessings and when the crises are averted, to perform prostration and praise Allah, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program, to my brother. And at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
The Dua'i Allama Majlisi in Tahab al-Anwar, he states that submission or ma'rifah of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt is that tomorrow, for instance, that if Imam Sahib al-Zaman, he comes into this masjid, and he stands in front of every single one of us, and he tells you, look at this apple. The right side of the apple is halal, and the left side of the apple is haram. That it's the responsibility of every single one of us to submit toward it unconditionally. Don't say, but how is the right side halal and the other side haram when they're part of one dimension in its entirety? No. Ma'rifah, absolute knowledge of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, is to submit unconditionally that if the Imam tells you put your sword away, you put your sword away. That this side of the apple is halal and the other side is haram, that's it, it's finished. And what made Malik al-Ashtar the recipient of such divine knowledge from Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam was this love, was this loyalty, was recognizing the wilaya of Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen in all of its unique capacity. The historians, they write that when Imam Ali alayhi salam is now the governor, or he's the fourth caliph, and he establishes his government in the holy city of Kufa. His first governor of Egypt was his adopted son, Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr. But due to the onslaught of Muawiyah from Damascus and his attempts toward overtaking the region of Egypt where Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr ruled, Imam Ali alayhi salam thought that he would make a strategic move toward placing Malik al-Ashtar, who was really smart, who was really chivalrous, who had a lot of bravery, but most importantly, he had a large army ready behind him to protect Egypt from any sort of onslaught from Muawiyah. So he writes a letter toward Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, relieving him of his duty, and then he goes towards sending Malik al-Ashtar toward Egypt so that he's able to take over the governorship of that region of his caliphate. What happened was that Malik al-Ashtar, on his way toward going toward Egypt, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam writes toward him this famous letter, letter 52 or letter 53 of Nahj al-Balagha, that many of us are obviously very familiar with. Malik al-Ashtar takes the letter, he goes toward Egypt, and when news began to spread in Damascus that Malik al-Ashtar is going to become the governor of Egypt, and at the same time he's going to bring forth his large army contingency, Muawiyah began to have a little bit of fear. So Amr ibn al-As goes toward Muawiyah. Of course, Amr ibn al-As, the close confidant of Muawiyah, he goes toward him and he says, hey, if we allow for Malik al-Ashtar to go toward establishing the governorship of Egypt, we're going to be in trouble. So they create a ploy, they make a system that on the journey between Kufa and Egypt, many people back in the day to take a lot of rest stops, right? Like today, for instance, if I'm driving from New York City toward Toronto, it's like an 8-10 hour drive. Every couple of hours, I need to stop, I need to get some coffee, I need to use the restroom, I need to compare Tim Hortons to a Dunkin' Donuts and all of those sorts of things. And you take his rest and you spend some time there. Back in that day, they would go and they would sleep in tents, they would park their camels and their horses, and there were people who would sell and distribute food and so on and so forth. Amr ibn al-As, he pays somebody in this journey between Kufa and Egypt, and he says, when you see Malik al-Ashtar come with his big contingency of followers and his army and his military personnel, give him this food mixed with this poison so that he's unable to reach Egypt. And in the outskirts of the city of Cairo, we come and we see that Malik al-Ashtar was poisoned and he was killed, and he was never able to act upon the instructions given toward him by Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. But nonetheless, those words of the commander of the faithful live forever in reality.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only 5. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she has inherited her family's martial arts. She is rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongqing village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years. Go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Qayyuba, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo. Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonios has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun, art, and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rakic have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, a while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. this ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abeloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia. Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran, but when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting, like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says His device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of